How are you feeling right now?
Generally good. I'm feeling good. I'm doing well. Yes, I'm ready to relax into this subject. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm aware that we're going to talk about a topic today. So we're going to talk about our daughter Florrie. And as soon as I say that, I notice my throat is already like, "Urgh." And it's a topic that we haven't talked about together, or probably with anybody for quite some time, I'd say. And I'm just aware that we're doing it in a more public way, so I'm trying to tune out to that and just really tune in to you. So I'm just aware these things are just landing in me right now. Do you feel good to talk about Florrie? Yeah.
Yes, it was a long time ago.
Yeah, how long ago now?
Well, it was 2011 that she was born
Right.
and obviously died a week later.
Yeah, should we share about what happened? One memory of the journey. Yeah, so obviously she was our third daughter. So we've got Martha, Elsie, and she was our third. And I remember saying to you, "This is it now, like this is our family complete." I remember her birth actually being amazing, like it was so pleasurable giving birth to her. It was special actually, wasn't it, that birth?
Yes, it was easeful.
Easeful,
and
yeah.
just in the small hours of the morning as the sun was rising. Most of the labour was done at home, and then
It was almost as I was getting out the bath at the hospital. Do you remember?
you were only in there for a few moments. I mean, we were in the hospital for an hour tops,
Less than.
yeah, before she came along.
Yeah.
So I drove like a madman 45 minutes through the Yorkshire Dales
Yeah.
to get to the hospital whilst you were in late stage labour.
And it was so perfect, like everything was so perfect. And I think that first week, we were obviously living very rural. We were living in the middle of the nowhere. We were starting a new project that was a massive, massive building project with lots of different volunteers and people coming on site every day. And so we took her back from hospital into that environment. And yeah, it just felt perfect. It felt like we were in completion. We were building something massive, very entrepreneurial, very, we had government funding, we had this amazing land, we had people on board. We had the whole community involved, really. We bought this new life, this new baby, and it was a really big season for us.
There was something about Florrie's pregnancy paralleling the creativity of what we were building in North Yorkshire.
Definitely. Never
So we
thought
were
about
going
that.
through design, planning permission, getting ready for the build, getting quotes in,
Yeah.
etc. And we used to talk about, or somebody did, about incubating two babies. There are two babies on the way.
Yeah.
And Florrie was born in the summer of 2011, about, can't remember exactly, but a few weeks, maybe a month after the building work had started. So we'd really started preparing, and there were a lot of people on site, machines, mud, contractors, you were late stage labour, and she was born literally as we were breaking ground just beyond. So the incubation of the two coincided perfectly.
Yeah, it felt like to me, we were plugged in to exactly what we were birthed to be doing. And yeah, anyway, she came, and then everything was perfect with her breastfeeding. The environment was crazy, but it all really worked. And it was just that one night where I noticed, during the night you were sleeping, and I noticed that as she was breathing out, she had a little cough, and she wasn't feeding as she normally would. And it was this little like after the feed, and I remember thinking she's getting a cold or she's coming down with something. And I said to myself, in the morning I'll take her to the midwife, because we live so far away from anything, it's easier sometimes to go out to get things than to wait for it to come to you. I remember you got up in the morning and went, because to one of your projects at that time to earn money was to go into Leeds.
Yeah, so that's an hour and a half drive away, and I started in the office early. So I woke early, quietly got ready for work, jumped in my car and went off for the day.
Yeah.
Before I think you both woke fully into the morning.
Yeah, it's true, you had gone. When I woke up, you were gone. And I woke up and I had in my mind to take her straight down to the clinic. And amazingly, my mum and dad were staying. They'd come up after the birth and they were staying with us just to support us at a crazy time. And I remember saying to my mum, I had a shower. She was with Flory. No, I left Flory on the middle of the bed. I went and had a shower. I came back. My hair was wet. And I remember thinking, I'll dry my hair. And I went to go and get the hair dryer. And I distinctly remember just looking at her on the bed. And I thought, her lips look quite blue. And I went over to her, but she was fine. She was very responsive. She was looking at me. And I thought, maybe it's cold. You know, we are in Yorkshire. It's always cold. But I didn't feel settled about it. Oof. And I'm just, it's so interesting. It's so long ago, but I can still feel these feelings in my body. And I came, long story short, I realised that actually she wasn't well at all and I needed to hurry up. So I forgot about my hair, threw on the clothes that were on the bedroom floor. And I just grabbed my mum and said, we need to go now. I'd made a phone call to, is it 111 where you get advice?
Something like
that. Yeah, and I remember on the phone to them saying, you know, they said, do this with a glass on her body and do this over her lips. And I told them everything that was happening. And they said, you need, we're going to call 999 now. And I said, we live where we lived. And she said, you'll be quicker to get in the car. And I said, great. So I remember with my mum, I just shouted at my mum, like, we've got to go now. We've got to get in the car. And I remember getting everything ready very fast, getting out to the door. My mum's in the car. And as our assistant, our main assistant, walked in, Andy, I just said to him, Flory's in trouble. I'm taking her to hospital. Hold everything. Look after everything. And just ran out the door. Getting in the car, we're going down the Yorkshire Dales. The roads were like this, you know. And I noticed that she had stopped breathing. She was on my shoulder like this, and so I remember putting her down on my legs in front of me, and I started doing CPR. And my mum's desperately trying to get to... Oh, I said to her, Mum, we cannot get to the hospital. It's too far. Go to the doctor's surgery. We'll just go to the doctor's surgery straight away. And I remember a car was very pissed off that my mum was driving so crazily, and it went right in the middle of the road and slowed down, and it put its hand out, and it was going like that, like, slow down, like, trying to... And I just remember, it was a red old Volvo. You know, I remember exactly just thinking, you have no idea what's going on in this car right now. Like, get out of the way. Eventually, my mum took a chance and overtook it. And, yeah. Anyway, got to the doctor's surgery and it was market day. The whole town was buzzing. It was crazy. And there was the flu jab clinic. And I remember there was a load of old people queuing even outside of the door of the doctor's surgery. And my mum stopped the car right in front of the queue. I got out and I just started shouting, like, my baby stopped breathing, like, you know, get out my way. I was just shouting, get out my way, get out my way. I was pushing people out the way. And I remember so quickly, this doctor's surgery just got cleared and we got taken straight into a room and these doctors appeared from nowhere and immediately everything started happening. And at that point, I was like, I need to get Sam. And I remember that they passed me a telephone and I repeatedly dialed you over and over and over again whilst they're working on her. They drilled, they managed, it was incredible. One of the doctors had just come from paediatric surgery, so they had still the tools in their bag to drill through her leg, straight into her main arteries, whatever it is,
bone marrow.
Bone, yeah, and they went straight in and they managed to really get her into a better place. I'm watching all of that whilst I'm repeatedly dialing you, and you just weren't answering the phone, you just wouldn't answer, and I was getting mad with you. pick up the phone, you know. Like, what was going on for you not answering me?
I don't remember missing a single call from you. So I was sitting at my desk in Leeds, working, and I don't remember a missed call, certainly not a sequence of them, as you're talking about. I was working, it was mid-morning, that I received a phone call from your dad. So that's the first call that I saw and responded to, an incoming call from your dad. And he was very stuttery, very stammery, which is unlike him, particularly back then, a clear communicator.
Mm.
And he simply sort of said, there's a problem, Sam, and you need to come right away. And I said, well, where are you? And he said, they've just got in an ambulance and they're going to hospital. I think that's all he said. And I was some distance away. So I literally left everything at my desk, including a half-eaten pastry, if I recall.
That's very serious for you.
Ditched it and ran to my car and drove like I'd stolen it. And then I received a call on the way to tell me not to come to the village, but to go to the hospital.
Right. Mm. I mean, I must have repeated dialed like 30 times. In the end, I just gave up. And whilst this is all going on inside the surgery, what I didn't know until later on, because it was all in the newspapers and there was photographs and everything of this happening, people were clearing the market. There's emergency, because the air ambulance needed to come down into the market square. And apparently it was just unbelievable how everyone just cleared their market stalls, got their vans, were going around knocking on doors saying, move your cars, and just cleared this space. And then the air ambulance came down and they wrapped us all up and they took me and Florrie up in the air ambulance. And I remember it all, but I remember it kind of as if I'm watching it. I remember even as I was getting into the air ambulance, I was watching myself get into the air ambulance. They put these ear defenders on me. And I remember it, I could watch me having the ear defenders put on. It was a very surreal, exchange there. And we flew to this first hospital. Again, you're in a helicopter. It's like not a usual thing, but the whole time, my entire system is just with this life that's in front of me. They had her all strapped in, like in this cage almost. We got to this first hospital and I remember going into this room. I wasn't allowed in the room with her, and I remember being in this room and that's when my hearing went weird, and my hearing was weird for 3 months. My hearing went so strange, and I had this kept on having this experience as if I was in the corner of a room. I was up there in the corner of the room and I could see the room. I had that for many months. Yeah, and then eventually I remember phoning a few people. I remember updating Facebook, asking people to pray for us, asking people just to like really be with Florrie spiritually. I remember speaking to a few people, and then you walked in. And as soon as you walked in, the feeling started. I could feel then. I could suddenly feel, and it felt very, very uncomfortable. Can you remember walking in?
Yeah, I can remember. It was probably a near 2-hour drive from the city that I was in, was at least an hour and a half south of where we were living, and you'd been flown north, so it was two and a half hour drive. I drove the entire thing at an obscene speed.
Mm.
Just sat in the outside lane, literally in a straight line as fast as I could go. I remember arriving at the hospital, and I remember being quite composed for the entirety of the drive, focused and composed, and in some way in a place of dialogue or prayer or reflection, really owning that a serious illness for Florence wasn't our story. So I arrived with some composure and groundedness, and I went to the reception desk and said that my daughter has been brought in. It's a hospital. I assumed like hundreds of people have been brought in.
Mm.
And she looked at me and immediately said, "Is it Mr. Hardwick? Come this way." And I remember in that moment thinking, there's something a bit different about what's occurring here. I haven't been asked to stand there for 10 minutes whilst they rummage through papers to work out who's gone where.
Yeah.
And I remember going straight through to an A&E space, and it was like, I mean, she was on a bed, and there were, I mean, to me, it looked and felt like 30 people just buzzing around her.
Mm.
And I couldn't get close.
Mm.
I chose not to get close. In that moment was in some freeze, like, this is big.
Mm.
It was almost like the space around her needed to be empty for the pace at which people and machines were being wheeled in.
Yeah, it was that whole journey, because that we were in that unit, we then moved upstairs and different doctors saying different things, and you know, it was this weird experience where you are organically created to be responsible for that life, and suddenly you've utterly lost that responsibility, and a group of other people that you've never met before are suddenly utterly responsible for the life. And this weird split is happening all the time. Your impulse can't be met, but you know in your head to trust these people, but your impulse keeps kicking in. So we ended up going upstairs. There was always something wrong with her heart. No, it's not her heart. We think it's something genetic. We're going to get another specialist. We're going to go there. Constant changing. This is unusual. She's not responding to this kind of thing. We don't know what this is. And the whole time we were just like, okay, taken. And we were very calm. I remember both of us being calm. I was quite disconnected in a way, and just like, you know, to her. I remember when we were in intensive care, I've got to be honest, I don't know what happened to you during that whole time. I know our parents turned up. I remember them turning up, but I don't remember engaging with them at all. I do remember that at one point I thought, I can't breathe, I can't cope with this. And I went to the toilet, pretended I needed the toilet. I kept on saying I need the toilet. But this time I went into the toilet, put the lid down, sat on it, and I remember my breast milk had been leaking and leaking without me noticing. My top was drenched. And I remember grabbing two loo rolls that were on the top of the, and I remember holding loo rolls over my breasts and just be like, catch up with what's happening. It was so fast. Everything felt so fast. And then suddenly I'm uncomfortable because I've got sticky, wet breast milk top, you know, and all the way through the layers, and I don't have any other clothes with me, I've got nothing else with me. I suddenly feel very uncomfortable. I don't want to be there. I don't want to be in that out there. I don't want to be in this toilet. I feel claustrophobic. I remember that so well, that toilet experience. And then it wasn't long after that they brought us into a side room. Do you remember the side room? They gave me a breast pump and the consultant came. Do you remember that?
That was at the later hospital, I think.
No. This was telling us that we're going to move to the next hospital.
Okay.
Do you remember? And he said, "We think actually you need a specialist. We think it's genetic. When you need to go to Newcastle, we're going to transfer you." Do you remember any of that?
No, I remember a side room towards the very end, which is quite different.
Yeah.
So I remember first of all being in A&E. On the ground floor, and that's where the chaos was.
Mm.
And then at some point they stabilized her enough to move from that space to intensive care,
which was
upstairs.
Yeah.
Intensive care had a sort of slower feel to it, but still there were a lot of machines and consultants coming in and out. They were attempting to work on her body in a way that needed more time. They needed to reduce the acid levels, and I remember them just asking us to wait. to be still in some form. And then I remember that's when people started coming to arrive. So your parents, I think my parents.
They did. But anyway, we ended up being transferred to Newcastle.
Well, yes, that in and of itself, I remember they couldn't stabilise her fully. So they did their best to stabilise her and then put her in an ambulance to transfer her.
Mm.
And I remember, I think we were taken in a taxi.
We were behind.
No, one of the things I really remember.
Oh no,
is
we
the
went
taxi
first.
Driver. No.
Oh.
The taxi driver was given an instruction to wait half an hour.
Yes.
And we were not allowed to travel with the ambulance.
That's right.
And I remember just clocking that.
Yeah.
That for some artificial reason, which I couldn't work out in the moment, she had to go ahead and she was separated from us and we were taxied half an hour later. And they at some point explained, and I can't remember whether it was before or after, but that was because if they needed to stop the taxi and work on her on the side
of the
road.
Stop
the ambulance and work on her on the side of the road. That we were not witness to that.
Yeah.
We were not there.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I remember arriving at Great North East Children's Hospital in Newcastle when she had already arrived, been put into an intensive care environment, and the Newcastle team were setting up and taking over.
Mm. I remember walking into that hospital thinking, this can't be a hospital. It was so like brand new and sparkly and clinical and everything shaped like strong shapes and strong angles. And I remember feeling, I'm not feeling strong angles right now. This is very jarring. I remember the environment meant a lot to me, to my neurodiversity, I guess. It was just like, this environment is not right. Like somehow it's not right. I remember feeling that.
Yeah, we'd come from an old NHS place built who knows when.
That was almost more cosy and comfortable in a way.
Yeah, and then we stepped into this brand modern, new, shiny, bright lights, big corridors.
Yeah.
Clean.
Also, in the other hospital, I'd become quite attached to that team quite quickly as being the people that were going to rescue us. And then suddenly there's this new team. And
Yes, a team that in some way were more clinical.
They were more clinical.
They were present. They were polite. They were clean. The last place was chaotic. Tubes, wires, blood.
What was so interesting about this transition from one hospital to the other is that we were being told all the time stories like you might need to be here for months, you know, we might get you an apartment and you need to think about what you're going to need. And so I'm like thinking on those terms, you know, there was definitely a moment when we were transferred that inside of me I remember saying to you in that horrible waiting room that they hadn't quite finished because it was so uncomfortable in that waiting room. There was nothing in it and there was nowhere to sit that was comfortable. And I remember saying to you, we're not going home with her. And you got really cross with me. You were like, you were firm with me to don't give up faith. Like, you know, and I remember you got quite firm with me and inside of me, I was like, no. I am tuning in to what I need to tune into because we're not going home with her. And I thought, right, he can't handle that. I'll keep it in myself. Your mum and dad were there at that point and then they left. And I remember you and I laid on this hard, cold floor to try and get a little bit of rest because we had been up now for absolutely hours. Do you remember that, falling asleep on that floor?
I do. Well, I remember you were in a place of surrender to whatever might happen, and I was, as you remember, I was talking to somebody about logistics, and it was a teaching hospital. They had accommodation immediately nearby, and they said they could make some of the nurses' digs available just 100 meters away. And then my parents arrived with an overnight bag, so for me, I was settling in to the idea that likely we were going to be living here for a while.
Yeah.
I think one of the surgeons had said that she had stabilised, but the outlook was not straightforward, and that we would be there for likely a number of weeks, 6+ weeks. I remember them saying that the fight for her had been so difficult that they were unsure whether she would survive or have a mix of complex disabilities.
That was much later. In between that, they said, she's lost a lot of blood. We need to give her a blood transfusion. And you go and rest, because setting her up for a blood transfusion is going to take a couple of hours. So so go and rest, get some sleep. And when the blood transfusion is happening, we'll bring you in and you can be with her. So that's when we laid on that hard floor. No covers, no pillow, no nothing. And we literally just went off to sleep like that.
Yeah.
And I have got, I mean, over the years, this particular memory that I'm going to share with you came back to me in flashbacks for years. And I had flashbacks for 2-3 years after this whole episode. And this was one of the scenes that would be replayed, which was, I'm sure you'll remember it, someone burst through the doors of that room, shouting at us, get up, you need to come now. That's how we woke up.
Yes, having slept for probably less than an hour or something.
Yeah. Went up into the room again, lots of people, and they were doing CPR. And I was just like, okay, this is actually happening, you know. This is actually happening right now. And I need to be here. I need to be here.
Yeah.
Do you remember the doctor coming over and asking us if they can stop?
I remember the noise, the beeps, the machines. I remember an element of panic and stuff being moved out of the way so they could get around her properly. The thing that stays with me the most, actually, was the person that was leading CPR turned to one of the, or perhaps a couple of the junior nurses that were present and asked them, I think she said something like, would you like a go? Would you like to take over? There was something about something about that moment where the medical person she had clearly concluded that it was game over, and she was inviting a junior staff member for the benefit of her learning.
I did not know that.
And I clocked it.
Yeah. That's an indication that things are happening, and, yeah.
Yeah, and it was that moment where this younger person was a bit nervous and said, yeah, okay, yeah, and then stepped in, and really that's when the decline was unfolding in front of us real time.
I remember we were reserving everything, and I remember this. I kind of even remember what she looks like, but she was quite a small and petite woman, and a very contained doctor.
Yes.
And she came over to us, and she said, "You know, this is the scenario, and we need your permission to stop." And I said to her, "If you carry on and she survives, what will her quality of life be? Like, do you know that?" I think her answer was something like, we have no idea, but with what she's gone through, there could be some very...
That was much earlier. I think They just asked up. They literally said...
Asked our permission.
They said, right, we believe she's gone.
I remember because I'd already had this surrender moment, I knew I couldn't fight anymore for something that was about me now. It wasn't about her. It was about me needing her to be alive. Whereas actually I was tuning in to her, almost saying to me, it's okay. Go with this, it's okay. And I remember, I'll never forget you, because we were then with her. And I remember washing her, cleaning her down. I put a fresh baby grow on her.
I had her blood still all on me, and I remember just cleaning up and being with her. It was the most, I think, to this moment of my life, 48 years of life, that moment of washing my baby when she's just gone was probably the most intimate experience, most spiritual experience I've ever had. And I remember then just holding her for several hours, and you came and took her off me, and you lifted her up like this, and you said quite loud, I remember feeling, oh, there's other people in this unit, like, I wonder what they might think. I remember thinking that and feeling that. And you went, so you said something like, you might remember the actual words, but you said something like, God, you gave this life to us, now take her home, you said. And I remember just in that moment just being like, this is not about what we want, what we thought it should be. This is about being with what is. And in that moment, our life completely changed. And I remember we going in the hours later when I actually felt that we gave her back too soon. I think I remember saying that to you. I wanted more time with her. I wasn't ready to. I remember getting in the taxi. They got us a taxi, and they gave us this massive box with the rattling inside was her baby grow, a cut of hair, a footprint, and weird things that you're taking away, but you're not taking your baby away. And I remember just saying to you, this is wrong. You know, this is not our story. This is so wrong to be going home without her. And I had for months in my body the feeling that I had done her wrong by leaving without her. I wanted to bring her home as she was, you know. There was something wrong about leaving her there. And if I could go back in time, I would have had longer with her. I would have had longer. You know, I remember them saying, I think that's probably, you know, it's a good time now for you to go. And you're so in shock that you're like, yeah, okay, you know. We did go to that side room, didn't we? And they gave us that telephone. And we had to make phone calls and tell people. Do you remember that? In the middle of the night, we're phoning people. That's very vague, but just came to me, that memory.
The side room was, we were phoning people as the situation was worsening. I remember phoning some dear friends that we were working with at the time, and a few other people. When she died, we didn't phone very many people. I remember phoning my dad and having a very brief discussion. Neither of us could talk. And I just said, she's gone. And we had a couple of other calls to that effect. And then it was mid-morning. We'd been up all night.
It was a mid-morning because we got back at 6 in the morning.
The sun was rising.
Yeah, the sun was rising, but it was still early.
Yeah, and I remember driving I think past my parents' house, and they watched us drive by and then got in the car and followed.
When we got to our house, they were just behind us. And I remember it was misty. It was the most stunning morning, misty and eerie. I remember as we got out, I couldn't handle seeing your parents. I remember going straight to the house, and I remember I heard your dad, as you were hugging your dad, I remember he said to you something like, my son, we're not prepared for this, or something. He said something, can you remember?
Yeah. He said, I mean, it was very brief. He said something like, we've never faced anything like this, but we will get through it together.
Right. I remember hearing something along those lines, and it was too much. I just was like, get away, you know. And I remember going to the house, and it was very bizarre. that usually our girls were quite good sleepers, and our girls were like normally not out of bed at that time of morning, but they were there, and they were wanting to like be with us, and to like, what, where have you been these last days, like what happened, you know. They were very much like rabbit in the head, like Martha with her blankie, and Elsie just like, you know, what's going on. And it was like, oh, I haven't got time to get in my house and think about how I'm going to do this. Oh, I've got to do it right now. So that was quite full on. To not have any buffer.
Yes. Yes, to have their two little faces, knowing that I didn't come home from work the night before.
Yeah.
You disappeared during the day and didn't come home.
Yeah.
Well,
I was away for a long period of time for them.
Yes. I mean, they were just, I think, likely with my mum.
And my dad, remember?
Yeah.
And my mum.
Yes. They were tag teaming back and forth. Back and forth to the hospital. And then suddenly we come home. We hadn't seen them meaningfully for 36 hours. And we're home without Florence.
Yeah.
And their two little faces side by side.
I remember Martha straight away. Where's Florrie?
Yeah.
Where's Florrie, Mummy? And I remember we took them into the lounge. I remember all our parents, both sets of parents were there. We sat them on that big leather sofa. And we told them.
Yeah. She's not coming home.
She's not coming home. She's died. What does it mean to die?
I don't think we got that far.
No, Martha.
Because Martha ran off.
No, she slowly pulled herself off the sofa. Went out the living room, walked halfway up the stairs, and froze.
Like a ghost.
She was like a ghost. She froze, and then she just wet herself. And she was like, she almost went into like, is it rigor mortis? Yeah. Like
just shock.
Like that on the stairs. And I remember like going up, and I realised that she'd wet herself everywhere. And I was like, and she was a kid that never wet herself, ever. And I remember just being like, Marthy, let's go upstairs, you know. That was the start of a new journey with her. There's so much detail to this story, but I think it's important to share that we went on a 7-month journey with a police investigation about why did she die, you know, what happened.
The piece that I want to just catch before that is the grieving journey of you and of the girls. I remember the days and the weeks that followed. We were all in deep grief, and for the girls, they were just aged 2 or 3, and they were trying to work out what had gone on and where was she and what had happened there. For you, I mean, Florence was a week old. So your milk had come in, of course. You were still healing from the birth. If I remember rightly, still bleeding from the birth. And your grief journey, I remember just being really deep, profound, earthy, earthly, of the earth. The grief of a mother whose baby has just died, whilst your hormones and your body are telling you that you are a new mother, but there is no baby there. And I remember the girls trying to work out what's going on here. Why are you, Beth, so in this deep experience, and where has their sister gone? And for me, I remember almost becoming an observer and a steward of your grief, of their grief. And for me, I was leading a building project, and it was the easiest route available to me at the time was probably just to go into a place of, I don't know, well, not quite denial, because it's all unfolding in front of me, but not to fully embrace my grieving journey, to to deepen into work, practicality. I mean, literally the next morning, I've got contractors in muddy boots saying, where do you want us to start today, Sam? Mm.
That was one of the hardest moments, when you need the world to stop, but the world will not stop and cannot stop, because we would have gone financially bankrupt overnight if we had stopped. Many people would have been impacted terribly if we had stopped. We were responsible for a huge project and a huge amount of people's incomes at that time, etc., etc. We could not stop.
No.
And I remember zipping up, saying to myself, this body and how you're feeling doesn't matter right now. What matters is what's going on for everybody and everything outside of me. And I wrapped myself up, shut myself away. And that was the beginning. And I saw you do the same. And how we survived is a miracle. But of course, we know that we had lots of impact from that wrapping up and not dealing with it.
Yeah.
Lots.
Well, there's a lot of practical things suddenly. There's a funeral. And because an infant has died unexplainedly, unexpectedly, I had no idea this happened, but the police start coming around. Mm. There's an investigation. It's led by the coroner.
Yeah.
And there are statements being taken. There are samples being taken around the house. There's the water supply. There's her bedding.
My saliva.
All these things are being swabbed and collected, and I'm being interviewed. You're being interviewed. Gently, carefully. Mm. But I'm noticing there's a precision about this. There's a precision about the quality of questions, of interviewing, of forensics that are being taken around us.
Mm.
There are questions being held, and we've got no explanation as to why she died.
I think when I look back, I mean, we found out 7 months later that she died of a very rare virus. Nothing to do with us. Something that was on the... Well, we don't even know where it came from. And actually, if she had lived up to 10 days, so 3 days more, she would have had the immunity to for them to have treated it.
Well, typically, the immunity develops.
Typically, yeah.
It develops in a newborn around 10 days.
But to have that news 7 months later was like the gift from God that I needed, because to not know why she died, well, she was a perfectly healthy baby, was very, very difficult. And it almost felt like then we can start working on life again. You know, her burial, everyone coming together to all of that, the celebration service, it was a miracle. All of it was incredible. Incredible, the support that we received. But what sticks out to me is how people responded to death and grief.
Mm.
You know, there were people that would cross the street to avoid me
because
they did not know what the hell to say to me. There were other people that would come towards me who I didn't know very well and want to tell me all the things in their life that they've grieved for and all the ways that they've lost things, people, and, you know... I can't hear this right now. I don't even know you very well, and you're sharing all this. It's so interesting, the variety of grief responses and inability to... What I found in the Christian community that we were very much part of back then, the Christian community needed to say, "You will see her again. You know, you will see her again," and kind of like all is not lost. Or it was like an inability to say, this is shit, that was hard, feel the feelings that you're feeling, they're okay. It was almost like, don't feel all of those feelings, because there's salvation, because there's this hope, because you're going to see her again. And actually, looking back, that wasn't helpful. That was not helpful for me, to be wrapped up like that and told repeatedly to celebrate that I will see her again. No, I wanted to let her go. I wanted to let her go. I wanted her to pass, you know. I needed that. Years later, doing ayahuasca Florrie came to me. I think I shared this with you. Like, that was my ayahuasca. It was me and Florrie, and her teaching me death is not death as humans think it is. You know, death is new life. And she was like showing me that it's in light, it's in passion, it's in sexuality, it's in energy, it's in your creativity. It's like, you know, and just showing me what her life had meant to me. And it was an incredible stark difference to the Christian message. And don't get me wrong, I don't want to put down the Christian culture completely in this, because it was incredible how they surrounded us with making us food, you know, getting alongside us, helping us in so many ways. Amazing. You know, the Christians know how to do community in that way. But in terms of the theme of death, did you find that? That there was just this inability to really allow death to be death?
Well, in the first instance, I found that most people were unable to talk about it, regardless of who they were. I think you are right that the Christian communities that were connected to moved quickly to support, practical support, bringing meals, and one or two close friends were able to have some dialogue. But really, I found that almost every person in our lives was unable to really dialogue with us. I had a boss that I worked with in Leeds, and she had lost a child, and she was, I think, the one person most capable of just asking the questions and holding. I mean, she was a very funny woman, a cynical woman, and knew the essence and knows the essence of love, and she was able to hold that balance of a dry humour, a line of inquiry. I felt seen, I felt heard, I felt held in some way by her friendship. And she was my boss in some way. And she was able to hold humour and her own lived experience also. And I remember her being an inspiration to me, that I would like to relate to others that have experienced loss with the level of skill that she was able to, with the level of empathy, connection, and humour that she was able to hold simultaneously. And then I found myself holding those things on other people's behalf when they were unable to find their own words or unable to connect with what part or what message might they bring in a moment of awkwardness. I in some way was able to navigate on their behalf. Was it connection? Was it empathy? Was it avoidance? Was it humour? Was it just a moment of knowing? And I learnt how I could create connection with others through my grief story when they were not able to be present with the reality of my grief, with my grief story.
It's a really good point. It's like, I think you can choose grief to be death, or you can choose grief to be new life. And I've, over the years, I've learnt, you know, what it meant to have a body that shut down. I had to learn how to reconnect my body, to release feelings, to feel feelings. I had to learn to find my voice. I had to learn, almost like being a baby again, I had to learn that my body had shut down, my sexuality was wrapped up in a box, that I had to learn that sexuality and spirituality are a dance together, and they are a beautiful dance if you know how to dance. And that in for me to heal, I had to really understand that spirituality and sexuality piece. You know, I had to learn that embodied trauma will direct the way I make decisions, the way I speak to people, the way I feel someone else's story. You know, I had to unwrap all of this stuff because of this beautiful invitation that my daughter gave me in her passing. You know, and that raw feeling. I remember feeling physically that I had a hole inside of me for years, that you could put your hand through my stomach and it would go through the other side. And it was learning about how to actually feel full again.
and how to feel the nuances of the cellular memory inside of you. I would never have gone on that journey if I hadn't met the cliff edge and fallen off it. But the amount of people I met that chose to die in grief, and then that became their story. They became death in their story. And I just was like, that's not me. Her life was not meant for me to die. Her life was meant for me to live. You know, the invitation she gave me and you and our children, and I think this is the greatest impact for us, is to live more consciously. How do we think, feel, react, respond? How do we make choices? You know, I remember you and I sat down together and said, we want to parent our children in the reality of life. Because people used to say to our girls crazy stories about death to try and help them feel better about it. And we were like, tell them the truth. Tell our children the truth about death, and the truth about love, and the truth about pain, and the truth about how you feel. And it's okay to be angry. It's okay to be anxious. It's okay to be all the reality that you are, as long as you are moving through it and doing something with it. And I think we've been very conscious about the way that we've parented our children, so that we are not victims of that story, but we are celebrants of it.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, it's now been 15 years. So over those 15 years, for me, the first five were a combination of numbing and feeling the impact of that loss and grief in my system. And then it was at the end, or after certainly 4 or 5 years, that I was deeply, I mean, immediately, of course, after she went, but with really some meaning a few years later, I was deeply deconstructing my worldview. Where had my views come from? The views that I hold, first of all, around death and faith and life and creativity and opportunity and being in some relationship with the divine in some way. What did that look like? That was all being deconstructed. And then it was just like pulling a thread. And as I started pulling that thread, it unraveled and unraveled fast. Until I was really deep in a worldview of questioning and deconstructing.
Yeah.
Deconstructing really every assumption, everything that was being presented to me as any flavor of fact would instantly get deconstructed.
Yeah. Absolutes became suddenly very questionable.
Yes, it was during that season that the vision for this podcast was born.
Yeah.
Because we began, I say began, really deeply, deeply, were asking for more stories, more sides of a story, more sides of the same story. Don't give me this narrative that's rooted in a certain worldview, whatever that worldview may be. Let's unpack it from multiple perspectives, multiple worldviews. And that really arose from going through that deep, deep deconstruction process ourselves. And it was only then, after we were able to really remain in that place of there being some truth in all stories, and there being some story making in all stories, or whatever it may be, but sitting with the validity of all experiences, with the validity of different interpretations, it's then that that you and I, in separate ways, started to reconstruct or choose a new worldview. I believe a worldview that is more open-minded and more inclusive.
More compassionate. Yeah.
Yeah, and embarked on a journey of wanting to deeply understand the human condition, even more so than we had up to that point.
Yeah. I'm going to ask you a question. It really stirs me. But it's really alive in me right now. If you could go back in time, and Flory would be the perfect birth, the perfect little girl, and she doesn't go into any of that story and remains healthy and vibrant, Would you take that story?
I have no idea. I feel a lightness around that question. Because, honestly, I don't know what the essence of human life is. And perhaps whether the spirit, whether the soul of Florrie knew in some way that she would be coming for a short period, or whether, I mean, who even knows when a soul starts to exist?
Mm.
And who even knows where a soul goes to after it leaves physical form? So, you know, selfishly, of course, I would... There's something in me that... I mean, Florrie was born 2 years after our second. And when I see our two girls with one of their friends, when I see three girls together having fun...
Yeah.
Like, nearly every time I will think of Florrie. I will think, what would it have been like to have had three... Right now, they are late teens. What would it be to have three late teen girls? My two girls are delightful and hilarious. When they're with one of their friends, it is all the more wonderful when they're all having fun. So, of course, I would love to be a dad to three teenage girls. Would we have had our fourth child? Who knows? He is a delight and he is a gift. Would we have been through the process of deconstruction and exploring and in some way expanding our worldview if we hadn't lost Florrie? I'm not sure we would have gone to that extent.
No.
And do I place value on a life that is long? Do I place more value on a life that is long? Or do
good
I place
question, yeah.
Do I place equal value on a life that may only have been 7 days long, but had a huge impact on me and on you and on others? Of course I would love to have my daughter with me, and who knows how life may have unfolded had she lived. Who knows if we would have brought baby number four into the world.
I feel so incredibly grateful for the impact that it wasn't just that we've had other traumas, big traumas, but the collective journey of our life, I'm grateful for how we have responded and what's come from that. When I think about our children are absolutely incredible, like how they communicate, how they think and feel about life and people, and you know, how just their essence. And I think that that's got a huge amount to do with you and I unpacking everything. Why? We've had everything taken away from us at different parts of our life, everything. And we've had to stand there raw and naked and say, what's the invitation here? And I think that was kicked off, even before Florrie, but kicked off deeply in us when we lost something that felt like it wasn't ours to lose almost. Something changed in us, and I would say that I would go through all of it again and lose her again for what we've gained collectively as a family. And not only that, all the people that we've been able to impact positively because of the way that we have approached the invitation through pain, the invitation through loss, through grief, through trauma. There is an invitation for so much richness and joy and pleasure and possibility that I would lose her again. And I honestly don't think I've lost her. I don't think now, sitting here, that I lost her, because something grew inside of me from that. Not initially, no, you're right. We had to go through the barren period. We had to go through the raw cliff edge period. But something birthed in me that I see as her purpose. So I don't necessarily think that I lost her in the long run. This bath is getting cold.
It is now and endurance.
I want to say thank you for sharing what you have shared with me. There's so much we can talk about. It's yes. hard in a way. We've lived 20 years together through yes. through a lot.
Yes.
But I kind of feel like I hope we've celebrated this story, because that's like, I'm just want to just, it's important to me, I think, if we just can highlight one or two things. If someone was listening to us right now, if someone is listening and they're at that really, really fucking raw stage where they're like, I'm angry and I'm not okay that so-and-so's just passed, and I'm not okay with it. Like, what would we say to that person? Or maybe someone who feels quite numb about all of these things, you know, what do we want to say?
It's difficult, because I've been in deep grief, and I would never want to bring a preach of any kind. I think for me there is value in being with the human experience. There is value in holding the grief and holding the pain and being with it. There is value in seeing yourself deeply and seeing the loss deeply. There is value in acknowledging the magnitude of it and being with it. And I think if I am at risk of drifting into any preaching territory, it is that there is life in being with the fullness of the human experience.
Absolutely.
Even if that is deep pain, loss, grief. To embrace that, there is life there.
Yeah, I think.
And there's a choice. There's a choice there.
I think that's so well put.
To be with the depth of that human experience.
Yeah.
And to embrace it in its fullness, and to not push it away. And the choice, I believe, is to choose the fullness of the human experience.
Yeah.
And then moving through loss and moving through grief. It's my story that became more easeful, and my hope would be for others that by really embracing it, really being with it, being with the impact of it, that it would be more easeful.
Yeah, and don't underplay how big it should be or how small it should be for you. You might have just lost your pet hamster and it might feel so raw, but because it was a pet hamster, you don't feel like you can really allow yourself to express that pain. You know, I totally concur with you. Be in it, feel it. It's not in our culture to really express, to really feel. We wrap people up. He's going to be okay. There's light at the end of the tunnel. No, be in the tunnel. Be in that tunnel. Feel the feelings. Be in the rawness of that experience. And keep moving with it, keep breathing it through, keep talking to people, write about it, sing about it, journal, you know, go for walks, be in nature, drink loads of water, eat healthy food, avoid the sugar. These are all things that will move you on. Quit alcohol for that time, you know, maybe, you know, but if in the time it helps to have a joint or have a, you know, be in it, but move it so you're not stuck or staying in it. I think that's a really key part. Feel it and be moving with it, because it will transform, it will change. No one can put a time frame on it. No one can put a time frame on it. I mean, I also, as you can imagine, are a massive advocate for people seeking support. You know, seek support, and seek support from people that have been through it or they are well adversed and experienced in it. So they are coming articulately to you. And sometimes I also think it's quite helpful to actually switch your ears off to some people that might even be your partner. It might even be like your parents, or it might be, you know, your pastor or someone that you normally actually have a lot of time for. Some people energetically will be needing to be blocked out from your energy field for a while. So be boundaried and be protective over yourself in that way. I think that's quite helpful.
It's been a long time since we've taken the time to really remember these memories, to be with it and to sit with it. And I notice in me that through this conversation, there is some feelings of completeness, some feelings of peace, feelings of, I think completeness is the word, that I can connect with parts of the experience, and overall I feel at peace with it.
Yeah, me too. I've really enjoyed talking about it. I'm very emotional now, but it's partly because I want to remain in the softness to connect with other people's stories. My own story is what you've shared. I'm at peace with it.
Yeah.
I celebrate it.
Yes.
I'm not in pain from it.
And I don't need anything from anyone in my own spirit.
Yeah.
In my heart, before the divine, I feel a sense of completeness.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. But I've really enjoyed talking about it with you.
Yes, likewise.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Let's get the fuck out of here.
It's bloody freezing.
If you're ready to deepen your relationships and learn how to show up more authentically in every part of your life, we really encourage you to check out ART, Authentic Relating Training. It's available worldwide, online and in person, and you can get a nice discount through our affiliate link. We've all done it. It's incredible. It's changed the way that we live life fully. And if this podcast matters to you, your support genuinely keeps us alive and it helps us create this space. You can find everything that you need, links and details and discounts, on our website or in the bio below. Take care.